My name is Rob Sofowitz. I am a writer and professor and sayer of things about comics. And lately, one of the things that I've been really interested in is this whole idea of comics in museums. First, if I could take a poll up here, how many people here think comic art belongs in a museum? Okay, that's we won that argument. So for the next hour, we're going to be talking about how and why we won that argument, and what happens next, and how do we turn museum shows about comics and pop culture and comics art into, you know, next generation attractions and spectacles that will bring in both traditional art fans and new generation fans. So I have an absolutely terrific panel of people here to help me discuss this. So first to my immediate left is Kim Munson. She is a scholar who specializes in this very subject of comic arts and museums, has been studying the history of that, and has a book coming out called From Panels to Frames, which is an anthology of writings about this. So please welcome Kim Munson. Her left is, if you were a reader or fan of Marvel Comics in the 80s, and stuff like New Mutants and Daredevil and all of these great titles, you probably know Anne Senti. She is also the writer of a really cool and excellent new title coming from Berger Books, imprint of Dark Horse, called Seeds, illustrated by the great David Aja. And this is, is it debuting at the show? Can I see it already, or is it?
It's premiering tomorrow.
Cool.
On sale August 1st, but Dark Horse has early copies.
So, but the reason that Anne is on this panel is I met her at, they had a great show in Seattle for the Art of Marvel. It's the largest collection of comics, artifacts, and art ever put on in the United States, I believe, and they had all kinds of great stuff, and Anne was part of the curatorial team for that, and I see in the audience some of the other members of the curatorial, we say, team for that show. So please welcome Anne Ascent. To her left, making his San Diego Comic-Con panel debut, straight from England, Adam Smith is the director of Comic-Con International's new comic art museum. There's a booth on the floor that's going to talk about that, and Adam is here to disclose some of the details about that and also talk about some of the strategies that he and the team at Comic-Con are thinking about in terms of putting some of this stuff into a museum context. And finally, our last panelist is everyone's favorite monster, Emile Ferris, the artist, writer of the years, decades, centuries, breakout graphic novel, My Favorite Thing is Monsters. Everybody's read this? Everybody's seen it? It's for sale at the Fantagraphics booth. It is awesome and excellent, and she is, not only is the style of this book fully in the great tradition of fine art comics and awesome storytelling, a lot of the story takes place using pictorial images from museums and from, or particularly from the Art Institute of Chicago, where Emile comes from. So please welcome Emile Ferris. Go team, we're awesome, we're ready to go. So I guess I'd like to begin maybe starting with Emile, because the... So in My Favorite Thing is Monsters, how many people have read the book?
Thank you.
It's one of my favorites. It's one of my favorite books.
It's awesome.
Thank you.
So in the book is takes place in the late 60s, and it's basically the plot is told through the eyes of a young protagonist named Karen Reyes, who... uses art, is it fair to say, uses art to help her sort of understand and articulate complicated things that are going on around her. Spends a lot of time in the art world Where does that come from? How influential was the seeing the art in museums? I assume some of this comes out of your own experience.
Yes.
So how did that impact you as an artist and a storyteller to see that stuff in a museum and then to get to sort of translate that into your work now? Does that make any sense?
You know, I grew up in a family of artists. My parents actually met at the Art Institute. And my father and mother would joke about it. My mother would say that she came home to my father by saying, you know, I'll stretch your canvases if you would clean. No, I'll clean your brushes if you would stretch my canvas. That's the off-color line that she gave. And somewhere in that school, I was made. And they kind of got wild. And they weren't married, and they made a person. In that, at that time, the school was over the museum. So as a kid, I used to walk from painting to painting and think, was it over this one? Or was it over this one? So my whole life was so deeply and intimately connected to that museum that I trace a lot of timeline in my life to, well, they used to have this exhibit as a permanent exhibit, or this changed. So I knew it really, really well. And it became my lexicon for understanding certain things. Teenager years were definitely Delvo and Magritte. I mean, you know, I absorbed those paintings and they became a, like I said, lexicon for many kinds of stuff like that answers.
I mean, one of the big battles that has been fought and almost won by this point is this idea that there's this high art that that we as a culture recognize as the, you know, work of geniuses that goes into a museum. We look at it on frames in the wall. And then there's popular art, things like illustration and commercial artwork and the lowest of the low, cartooning, especially for comic books. And that gap has been closing. You dealt with that a little bit. You sort of face that personally.
Well, I had a family member who was a stupendous artist, but we were supposed to have a show, and his family member said, you can't be in it because you're not a fine artist. And so this idea of a fine artist, you know, I mean, I always thought, wow, what is that? You know, because the greatest work I've ever seen is comics. And the greatest creators were these fluid drawers who could just imbue their images with emotion and depth and tell stories. And because I had the good fortune to have a father who loved comics, I very early on began to attribute stories to the images I saw and realized that the paintings were just not complete. It wasn't that the comics were wrong. It's the paintings lacked the narrative that the comics had. And so, sorry, fine art world.
So, Kim, you've been studying the history of this. Can you kind of take us through the highlights of how this sort of popular art form found its way gradually into the museum world and the sort of the moments of breakthrough when the shows that happened that sort of started to change people's minds about what was possible in terms of displaying cartooning in museums?
Well, so far, I've researched comic shows back to the 30s. And 1930s shows were, you know, they'd run for like 2 weeks and travel really fast, but they were very popular. Comic shows were incredibly popular during the 1940s, during the war era. Like the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York had comic shows like every 3 months or so. Then there was, in 1942, there was a show in New York that traveled all over the United States that was sponsored by the American Association of Graphic Artists. And they were the first ones to really put comics in like the kind of historical framework that we know now, you know, starting with hieroglyphics and working through the whole thing. And they borrowed real artwork, real Rembrandt etchings and Mayan sculptures and all kinds of stuff to illustrate the story. Then the censorship era happened in the 50s, The NCA, the National Cartoonist Society, really fought against that. They had a lot of shows. There started to be more breakout shows in the 60s because the pop art era kind of brought more attention back to comics as art, even though that was a real controversy, obviously. And then in the 70s, it just really took off, and we got more recognition. There were shows at the Louvre in Paris, lots of great stuff going on, and it just kept building. In the 90s, there was a show at the Metro, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York that was called High and Low, Modern Art, Popular Culture. It was very controversial. It was the first time that MoMA actually brought comic art in and really recognized it. And then there was Masters of Comics in 2005 that really kind of set up the canon that we started thinking about. And it's just kept opening up and opening up ever since.
How many of you guys have seen shows of comic art in museums? Pretty good. How many of you would go if there was one near you? Yeah, the thing that really opened my eyes about this was, so I'm from Seattle, and there was a show at the Seattle Art Museum, which is like our big regular art museum in Seattle, and it was called Masters of Illustration. It had 500 years of illustration art, and it started with Rembrandt and Goya and Dürer and Picasso. So it's basically the Mount Rushmore of great Western art for the last 500 years. And then after you had gone through this and you'd seen all the Picassos and all of this stuff, there was three rooms that showed the complete genesis by Robert Crumb. That was the capper to this exhibit. So not only is the only, you know, is Crumb the only living artist included among this illustrious group, he's also a comic artist. And so I talked to the curator at Seattle Art Museum and said, you know, so was this at all controversial to bring in a comic art guy like Crumb into a museum context? And she said, no, she said, because more people have heard of Crumb than have heard of Picasso, so this is a good way to introduce younger people to, you know, like the rest of Western art. And she said the whole board of directors and everybody was super enthusiastic about it. So it's really been a sort of a sea change for that. The other big show that we had in Seattle is the one that opened in April at the MoPOP Museum, which is our sort of museum of popular culture down by the Space Needle. And this is a show of Marvel superheroes art. I just saw the chief curator of the show, Dr. Ben Saunders, walk in earlier. But Annie is part of the curatorial team. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and how that came to be?
Well, I think, actually I feel a little silly being up here because we have, like, the two main curators in the room. And, you know, I just want to recognize we've got Ben Saunders. We've got, stand up and take a round of applause, guys. These are my collaborators who did way more. And all three of those guys. So, you know, when I talk about it, I have to, you know, the other day I was looking, because I'm working on a comic now that has bees in it, the seeds, the one you mentioned, and I was looking at hieroglyphs, Egyptian hieroglyphs, and I'm like, and it was a whole narrative, and I was like, this is the first comic. This is like sequential art. It was, you know, there are the bees, and there's taking the honey out, and there's bringing it to the pharaoh, and there's the whole thing. And so early on when we started working on the MoPOP Museum, my obsession, as all these guys know, was comics is sequential art. Comics is storytelling. And so when people think of comic art in museums, yes, you can find a cover or a single piece of artwork that's spectacular, as we have in the MoPOP Seattle. But really, the beauty of comics is the art of sequential, you know, telling a story. So one of the things we talked about early on in MoPOP is, should our museum have a story? And then what you just were talking about, sure enough, the rise and fall of the comic book industry is a great narrative. Mm-hmm. And you have, I came of age in comics in the 80s. I was working at Marvel Comics when, you know, I did a comic with Steve Ditko. I mean, Maurice Severin's in the office. And at the time, there was a guy, Jack Abel, who worked in the bullpen. And people were looking at Lichtenstein, you know, yeah. Probably said that name wrong, but, you know, he would take a single comic frame, blow it up, put it in a museum, sell it for millions of dollars, and, you know, Jack Abel, it would be Jack Abel's panel, and he'd be sitting in the bullpen, he was like an awesome guy, and he'd just be like, oh yeah, they just sold one of my panels for millions, and, you know, it's like, kind of, there's something wrong with this picture.
Yeah, actually, historically, the shows that really started to happen in the 60s and 70s were comics people that were responding to pop art and showing that the real thing is cool, too.
And you have this, before we did the MoPop Museum, we did the same company, we did a Magic City, and the art of street art. And so you have people like, you know, you had people putting the Hulk and Thing on trains. You had people like Basquiat. You had all these like street artists that were like homaging skateboard culture. You know, they were homaging their how they felt about comic book art. So I think it's a complicated question. If you want to say, here's comic book art, and here's Michelangelo and Picasso, it's a hard thing to make an equation about because of how sequential art comes into play.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that I asked you to be on the panel is because uniquely, you know, you've worked in the industry and you've seen it as an industry, as a commercial venture, and you were also working with people who were very self-consciously creating, you know, artwork that maybe was meant to last a little bit longer. So you're kind of in an interesting position. You saw some of that work being created for its original purpose, which was storytelling.
But I think back then nobody thought it would last. I mean, you know, you would all be drawing, and, you know, including Jack Kirby and everyone else, and the pages would sit around the office, and sometimes the artists wouldn't even want them back, you know, and sometimes they would end up in a garbage pail. So I don't think that anybody was thinking this is... And then in the 80s, with Spiegelman's Mouse, and there were certain comics, and then there'd be like an editorial in the New York Times, are comics art, you know?
Yeah.
And honestly, we were making comics, and we sat and went, I don't know, are they? Maybe, you know? So, anyway.
Yeah, no, so Adam, you're coming at this from the museum side, and less so from the comic side. For those who are not familiar with what's going on with the Comic-Con Art Museum project, and let us know kind of what you're doing and how you're starting to think about all of this stuff.
Sure. Afternoon, everyone. So for those of you that are not aware, Comic-Con is making a pretty big step as an organization. The organization has basically put this event on for the last 49 years. But about 2 years ago, they started looking at the idea of having a 365-day-a-year museum. And then the opportunity came up to get a really nice building in Balboa Park here, which is the cultural heart of San Diego. If you've never been there, there's already 17 museums and art galleries in Balboa Park. And the opportunity came up for Comic-Con to be given basically the free use of a 68,000-square-foot building right in the heart of this wonderful cultural district. So that put in motion a set of circumstances that led me here. I'm coming at this conversation for sure from the museum side. I have, from age 16 until now, I'm 46, I've done nothing other than work in museums. And I've worked in a farming museum and a golf museum and a coal mining museum and three aviation museums. And I think what I'm trying to bring to Comic-Con and to this conversation, obviously I am learning a lot about comic art and soaking in the knowledge of the many, many passionate people around me, and I've learned a lot even in the last 15 minutes. What I'm trying to do is to match that with my professional knowledge about how museums work, how human beings interact with these spaces, how we present a topic to the general public, as well as people like you that are fans and really passionate about something. When I interviewed for this job with Comic-Con, I said that my experience in museums is that more than 90% of anyone that will ever walk through the front door of the Comic-Con Museum will not be a fan. they will know very, very little about the subject matter. And part of our job, of course, is to make them a fan and educate them and raise their level of knowledge. But one of the dangers that any fan-based subject can have is that we make museums for ourselves and for our own interests, and we don't reach out, make that handshake or build that bridge to the people that don't know anything. So I guess they hired me, so I guess they accepted that line of argument about how we're going to present the Comic-Con Museum. The challenge that I gladly accept is the challenge to make you all happy and thrilled, but also the other people that come into the space. And partly that's about creating a successful business model around a museum. I am of the opinion that over 90% of all museums are basically business failures. They're operating in some kind of failure mode. I see a few heads nodding. Maybe some museum people in the room. With the Comic-Con Museum, I want to be in that 10% that is viable, is sustainable. And I will say, it does scare me a little bit when I look at the fate of some of the comic art museums that have tried over the last 20 years or so. I went up to the Cartoon Art Museum in San Francisco. Has anyone been there? Okay, a few of you have. First of all, I want to encourage you all to go because it's a great... If you love comic art, it is a great place. When I went there, it's very well presented, very well curated, great exhibits. But they really need more visitors in order to survive. They need more members in order to survive. So please go and share it with all your friends and like their Facebook page, because if you believe in this stuff, we have to support the museums that are out there. But as I look at Comic-Con Museum and what we're trying to do, I have to build something that a lot of people will come and see. So from a design perspective, the way we're laying out our building is we have three floors. One of them will be dedicated to comics and comic art, and there will be a comic art gallery inside of it. But in many ways, the other two floors are about making it possible to do that from an economic point of view, if that makes sense. Because I know that not enough people will come only to see comic art in order to sustain it. That's a reality. So we're trying to create a special place for comic art because it occupies a special place in the heart of this organization. But as you see us roll out what we actually do, it won't be everything that we do, if that makes sense.
So one of the very first comic art museums and most serious ones that was done was in Northampton, Massachusetts, and it was done by Kevin Eastman, who is the co-creator of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, for whom it is fair to say money was not a problem. despite that, the museum was not a huge success and pretty much closed its doors after 4 or 5 years. So there's the landscape is unfortunately littered with cautionary examples for that. Annie, did you have something you wanted to jump in on?
Well, the one thing I would say about that is that, again, with my colleagues, Ben and Brooks and Matt and Randy, one of the things that they put together was when you said that thing about isolating the comic art separate from the money making, to me that felt like putting the comics in a ghetto. Whereas one of the things that I loved about MoPop was that the MoPop exhibit is that, you know, here's a film prop and then here's a piece of comic art and they start to talk to each other. And here's a table where you can look deep into the history. Who was the first person to write or draw Black Panther? And the different mediums, be it the soundtrack that Lauren Bamp did, that was or the props, then the original drawings, they all start to talk to each other. And I would be fearful of having this is the floor we make money on, and maybe people will go and see the other floor. That would be my one thought.
Well, I'm going to debate you.
Yes, yes, now, finally.
Well, wait, so also, okay. I think it's interesting. I think that comic art is getting more normalized in museums. Because also about the time that you guys will probably open, the Lucas Museum will be opening in L.A. They have a huge comic art collection. They'll probably do something. They bought Crumb's Genesis, the whole thing.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that in the museum in Seattle, and I think that comic art will have more of a renaissance.
Well, let me start by commenting on the Lucas Museum, because that's obviously on my mind. Budget for that project, if I believe the newspapers, is $1.5 billion.
What?
And when I go to their website and when I look at how it's being presented, it could not be coming at this subject from a more different place than where Comic-Con's going to come at it.
Yeah.
And that's I don't object to that, but I will make this observation that it's very clear that the Lucas Museum is viewing comic art and narrative art through the lens of what I would call a fine art museum. It is looking at the established art galleries and saying, we aspire to be like that, and we are going to create one of those for this subject matter. I am coming at this from the perspective that this is more like the place I'm looking at is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This stuff was created, this art was created as popular culture. This event here is rock and roll. I don't think it is a symphony orchestra or that kind of fine art. Definitely, I want to root Comic-Con Museum in the people that come here, the fans that come here, and their passions and what drives them. And I don't want to make our museum an elitist museum. And when I look at Lucas, it is every message that's coming out of that project is very elitist.
Although, if I can be a real brat here, I mean, Dickens and Shakespeare were populist and for the people. And I agree, you shouldn't be elitist, but neither should, you know, you just say this is pop culture, because you don't know yet.
So I have one quick question for Milan, and actually I'd like to hear, because there's a lot of expertise in this room that's not on the stage here too.
Yes, yeah, way
to
more
speak
than
out. But one question for Milan, having heard all of this stuff, so you are a visual artist, you're also a visual storyteller, you're creating your work in a book because it's meant to be read as a story. How do you think, or do you think, displaying your work in a museum format could do it justice? Do you think that might be the right place for it?
I'm scared now. I'm gonna say though, I do have a show coming up, but I actually heard about you, Carol, that you designed something where you could walk into the head, Carol's head. And I was just like, yeah. I was like, that's the kind of shit I want to do.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I want to walk into Carol's head. But, you know, I don't think those things are mutually exclusive, because I just attended an amazing exhibit it's right up my alley. It's about Blake, William Blake, and his effect on people like Bob Dylan and Jimi Hendrix, and it was and many visual artists. It was a stupendous exhibit with lots of audio and visuals and things you could do. You could kind of have an acid trip. You could go into this, not literally, I wouldn't really love that, but it was like you could go into this little room and it was, you know, you could watch a psychedelic film that was actually made in 1968 with all kinds of Blakean references in it. I think that a museum can be a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it's limited. I think that it's, here's the thing that I love this term, a familiar strange. Has anybody learned about that? You know about that?
Thank you.
You probably could, during question answer time, educate me a little bit about it, but I just was at a conference and somebody talked about it, and I think it's that mentality of looking at something we all love and we're incredibly familiar with, but really abstracting our vision and seeing it through the eyes of maybe somebody who isn't familiar with Holt's, you know, pathos and his art of creation. Somebody who doesn't understand what this means. And, you know, one of the things in the creation of my book, I'll do with this, is that I was so attracted to the Wolfman, right? But I didn't realize that the Wolfman movie of the 1930s was written by a German Jew who had just fled from the Nazis. And the reason that the pentagram was in the poem is because in his experience in the last 3 years during the labeling of people with stars, stars meant death. So he creates this great metaphor, but unless you get the education about what this means, and that's what a museum can do. It can create greater depth for the person who enjoys this. And I think that the familiar strange approaching with that mentality and knowing that there's so much, I mean, this is the richest medium in so many ways.
I think that reminds me of, well, for one thing, what I said about Lichtenstein, I always say his name wrong. I mean, that is in a weird way, what he was doing. He was saying, well, all these dots that, you know, because back then it was a four-color press. You had a yellow, blue, and red sheet. And, you know, he was saying the familiar strange. He was saying, well, let's blow these dots up. So there was a valid familiar strange thing going on there. But the other thing that I always come back to as someone who, you know, who makes comics, the art of comics is the art of storytelling. And today, so many of the best comic artists work digitally. There is no art. So how do you say the art, you know, sequential art? How do you put the beauty of that into a museum when there is no art? So you know that.
Well, maybe you project it in terms of labels.
Yes.
You know, maybe you create a hologram, and that maybe these images are. Then there's a heightened experience of seeing this beautiful digitally created environment, but in a holographic world. And I mean, certainly we're going to be dealing with virtual stuff. So maybe this museum is groundbreaking. You know, and I'm saying all this to you now.
I mean, this is one of the cool things about the MoPop show, and before that, the show that Charles Hatfield did for Jack Kirby, that was sort of taking some of this artwork and blowing it up into these really sort of cool, gigantic, experiential things. So that, because sometimes just looking at the black and white marks on the page doesn't convey that emotional heft that you get from reading a Jack Kirby story, to at least provide a visitor to the museum with that semblance of that experience, you can rely on some technology, you can rely on some things that are immersive in that only the museum can provide, that's different from being in a book. At this point, if folks have questions...
Can I respond to the suggestion that the Comic-Con Museum is ghettoizing comic art? Please.
I am famously a brat, so go ahead, have at me.
Okay, first of all, just because I said that we were dedicating a floor of our three-floor facility to comic art, I didn't say that comic art wouldn't be on the other two floors.
Okay. Point taken. Cool. Questions?
The intent of dedicating an entire floor to it is to honor it and to celebrate it. But actually, serious point, the decision to do that, it is not coincidental that it came after I went to see the exhibit that several of you worked on at MoPop. And let me talk you through the thought process. First of all, thank you for doing that exhibit. I know there's several people in the room that worked on that exhibit. I've been twice to Seattle already to see it, because when I read the prospectus of what you were trying to achieve, or what you are trying to achieve with that exhibit, it read like the manifesto of what I'm trying to achieve at large with Comic-Con Museum. So all the goals you set out for your exhibit are very similar to the goals that we're trying to achieve with Comic-Con Museum. So thank you for doing it, because it's a great focus group for me. It's a great opportunity to come and learn. And any comments that I make about it, please understand they're made with respect, because this is not easy, and I ain't done anything yet, you know. So I appreciate what you've done. My conclusion, first of all, understand that I'm a little bit of a museum weirdo. You will see me skulking in the corner watching human behavior. That's part of what I do, is I'll sometimes stand for...
You're in the right place.
Yeah, right. For 30 minutes to see how people use and interact with the space. I also use my own judgment about how I feel about an exhibit, etc. My take on the MoPop exhibit is that I think you all love it because the art that has been assembled there is probably the greatest collection of Marvel original art that's ever been brought together in one place ever, and great job for you guys in curating that and bringing it together.
Well, those people who did this.
But those my observation of human behavior is that I think a lot of the audience going through that exhibit is just skipping right by it because it is surrounded by all this color and the vibrancy and the multimedia displays and the TVs, etc., etc. And that art is black and white. And if you know what it is and you know what it represents and you're in that 10% of people that I talked about earlier that really cares about this stuff, you love it and you know it for what it is. But I think a lot of the other 90%, they're just walking on by because there's Black Panther's costume.
But isn't that always the way?
Well,
let me
help you understand how that translates into a decision that we made about Comic-Con Museum and how to present the art. One of the reasons we wanted to have a specific art gallery that is actually going to be quite clean, you know, like the San Francisco Museum, clean walls, art on walls, is because if you want people to view it as art and concentrate on it, removing the distractions. I understand you made a good point about how you can make interrelationships between artifacts and art, but if sometimes, you know, as I say, we got three floors, and we want to have one place where people can look at it as art. And we're all socially conditioned to do certain things. You come and sit in a theater, and you are ready to receive our presentation. You walk in an art gallery, you are conditioned to look at what is on the wall in a different way. So that you guys definitely influenced a design decision we make about how to lay out our building.
And there's also an issue of scale because, yeah. You know, like when you go to like the Museum of Modern Art and there's a huge gallery that's set up for like abstract expressionist paintings, comic art gets like swallowed, you know, and like galleries that really focus on something the scale of comic art really helps direct your attention into that and show it to its best advantage.
I think those are all valid points, and I think one of the things that Brooks and Ben tried to do was have, we didn't have that much space, you know, and it's a weird space at MoPop, it curls around, and so they tried, despite that, to have a sense of like a hallway you walk down and a presentation of a really important piece of comic art. So we literally tried to create the hallowed museum space like you're talking about within the larger multimedia. But also I don't know if you have to worry about this at all. Maybe you do, but we had to present not only the history of Marvel Comics and the artwork, but also all the other mediums. So I don't know.
As I said, it's not easy.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy. And plus, you also, it's all the companies, right? So
in the 10 minutes remaining or so, if there are any questions from the audience, Mark?
One of the challenges that you face with dealing with comic art in exhibits is that you're putting up the art, but you're leaving out the story part. And which is one of the things that Chrome Genesis did, which is so rare, which is to actually give you the entire narrative of the book. What are your thoughts on how you can address that challenge?
Well, narrative is a huge issue in these. Some people get around it by doing short stories, like two-page stories, or they do like a story arc, like 4 or 5 pages that sort of give you the whole beat of a story. Other ones, you know, like I interviewed Art Spiegelman about the retrospective that he did where they showed the whole mouse, and he thought it was too much. It's sort of like you know, what do you cut out of Mouse? That's a hard decision. But he felt actually like it was too much. He thought that showing Crumb's whole genesis was too much.
But I also think that you can do, like, Gasoline Alley. You know, it's here is a one image that is broken into 12 frames that tell two stories. You can look at the whole thing, and then you can also, you know, somebody's building a house, and then you can also, you know, the art of when do you choose a horizontal panel, when do you choose a vertical panel, which, you know, when do you take panels out. I mean, there's ways to say this is the art of storytelling without having to do an entire story, although at the same time, the Society of Illustrators just did a, I think it was a, you know, focused on John Romita Sr. and I did get to walk and read an entire comic on a wall, and it was really fun to do that. So I think you can do both.
The gentleman at the mic.
So kind of following up on that, you know, you talk a lot about original art on display, and when we talk about that, we're talking about generally at best. It's a collaborative medium, leaving out script and colors and lettering, and how to make sure that's all represented in the artistic context it deserves, which is not generally considered the same kind of stuff that you would paint in a museum, like an original painting or an original drawing.
Well, to answer that from OPOP, I think Randy and Matt worked very hard to make sure that we had these interactive, we have these big interactive screens where you can see here's the script, here's the pencils, here's the inks, here's the lettering, here's the coloring. And also, I don't know if Karen Green is still here.
No.
But Karen Green has, you know, she does shows at Columbia University, and she has, where you can see here are, you know, Chris Claremont's notes for this story, and you know, you can see everything. It's not just the sketchbook of the artist, it's the sketchbook of the writer, and I think that whole process was respected in mostly what Randy and Matt did. They did these deep infographics that you can go into. I don't know how that's going to be addressed, but it's important.
Thank you, great question. Get the last two like that. Yes.
So I love art and comics, but I love museums. And I partly what makes comics wonderful is they are unique in their ability to tell a story. But I feel like museums can do the same thing. And I think that's what's been missing for a long time, where you try to get everything together because comics are so varied and there's so much that goes into them. My husband and I saw a great exhibit about Guillermo del Toro's collection.
That is a great show.
Yeah.
It was a fabulous show because it told the story, and you got to start to see all the things that pulled together his brain to make these fabulous movies. And so I'm wondering how this museum will address that, in that you have three floors and the opportunity to really tell the story and bring people through the story.
Come to the museum panel on Sunday. We'll have a whole hour on that subject.
I'm an interior designer and I'm very interested in museum design, so I am coming.
Yeah. Actually, it is very, very difficult for me to succinctly answer that question, other than to say what you desire is what we aspire to do. When you talked of your love of museums, I think part of what's going on with comic art is that people are coming to see it not just as art, but as sort of historical artifact. This is a thing that this person that I revere, their hand touched it. People talk to me about Jack Kirby's original art, and you can smell the cigar smoke. And yeah. You know, when I talked about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame being one of my touchstones in this, one of the reasons that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame means something to me is that the entire history of rock and roll is within living memory. Pretty much everyone that goes to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they have a personal connection to it. And I think pretty much everyone that's going to walk into the Comic-Con Museum, it's this sort of random visit they're making. They have passions. They have their own life's experience. And so what they're bringing is the sort of a deeper connection, a deeper personal connection with the art. So I think, I find it very difficult to be concise, but I think what you're getting at is that there's, that in some ways, yes, we're an art gallery, but we are a museum and a cultural center as well, and sort of blending all that into a place that works is what we're trying to do.
Well, and I think actually, also, like, Ben can answer, Saunders is here, he could probably answer the question better, but this when he said this is an hour conversation, it's like, we talked about it for a year. You know, it's sort of like, do you do a historical narrative? There are many narratives you could do, and there was a natural narrative that came out because Marvel Comics went through periods of total economic collapse. They also had the Seduction of the Innocent book pretty much shut down the comic book industry. So there were natural dramatic highs and lows built into the Marvel narrative that were just a natural good damn story. You know, so you wrestle with, and he's going to have a billion meetings about this where you're like, what story? There's a lot of stories you could tell. Which one will work as the narrative? And I think that another thing that Ben did was he focused on the immigrant, you know, that opens with, what is the quote from Jack Kirby about? So that quote is so powerful today, and it resonates so strongly. And I, worked on this museum, but I didn't actually know that was the quote that was going to open it. And when I first walked into MoPop and went, holy shit, that's the quote. And, it just these were Lower East Side Jewish, and having these power, these feelings of marginalization, that's another narrative. Marvel Comics has really been the narrative of marginalization, seeking power, and now it's the narrative of gender, of race, of do I see myself in this comic? And so you start layering the potential narratives, and you don't have to actually say it. You just put things together so that people are, like, following a narrative. So, that's a great question.
Well, memory and context are so important. In 1939, the Metropolitan Museum of Art bought, like, a cell from Snow White, of like, two vultures waiting for Snow White to eat the apple and croak. Mm. And the curator was like, this is an artifact that has meaning because we all know what that scene in the movie was. And I think that goes to Adam's point where people have an attachment to the artifact, the thing that the artist touched, or the thing that the artist really did. And I think that that's a really important thing that museums can do for people is to bring that connection together.
So I was really hoping that we could take the one last question at the mic. Unfortunately, there's another panel coming in behind us. Half the room is basically waiting for. So I apologize. We can take this out in the hallway afterwards because I think we'll all be out there. But I want to give the panelists an opportunity to let us know where they will be for the rest of the convention and how to get a hold of you and your publications and stuff like that.
My book is coming out next year. It's From Panels to Frames, Comic Art and Museums from University of Mississippi Press. And basically, I'm hanging out in the CAC room listening to academic stuff. So,
I have a panel tomorrow. What's today? Tomorrow I have a panel. It's a debate on what's the best superpower. So that's going to be fun. We got kind of a great lineup of talent for that. And then I'm doing Dark Horse Burger Books. Karen Berger is launching the second wave of her new books. And so G. Willow Wilson has a new book. And blanking on his name, the guy that wrote Halt and Fire, the TV show, his comic. So we're doing Burger Books, and we're doing signings at the Dark Horse Books. And then there's a spotlight on my 30-year comic career called Ask Her Anything. And I'll answer. So.
Comic-Con Museum has a booth at booth 1740. Opportunity for you to submit your ideas for what you'd like to see. We have a panel on Sunday at noon, so we have a whole hour just on FAQs about the museum. I see a couple of people in the room that I want to give a shout out to. Firstly, Jack Kirby Museum is in the room, and I want to say that I really love everything that Jack Kirby Museum is doing to support those guys. And I would love for a Comic-Con Museum to collaborate with you guys on a really fantastic Jack Kirby exhibit. And I see Scott McLeod in the room. And I do want to say, as a newcomer to comic art, Scott's book, Understanding Comics, which is 25 years old this year, was absolutely a revelation to me personally, and it's been so helpful. And we want to have a gallery that my highest ambition is that it can bring some of the insights from Scott's book to life for all those people I talked about earlier that have never been exposed to it. So
when's your panel on Sunday?
Noon on Sunday.
Very good.
Quickly, because we've been told to stop in the middle, our spotlight panel and other things, you can come by Fantagraphics and I will sign a book for you. And I don't have anything more to say now.
And one last moderator's privilege here. So if you are interested in this topic, I have a long piece in the brand new, beautiful Full Bleed number 2 from IDW out today over at the booth. I'll be doing a signing there on Friday afternoon. I have a panel on Saturday afternoon, 5 o'clock for Fantagraphics. And then I'm doing, in direct conflict with Adams, spotlight on Jason Lutz and his monumental graphic novel, Berlin, Sunday at noon. We will be out on the hall in the hallway. If you're interested, hit me up at Rob Stelk on Twitter. Thank you all. This has been an awesome panel. Thanks for...